and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Chris Jones. Russia's election is done and dusted, and it went exactly how we knew it would. Vladimir Putin won with a landslide of 87%, cementing his position at the summit of the Kremlin. His victory exemplifies his immense control over Russia and the influence he has in all corners of society and how it sees the world. But what are his views of the world today? And how does the way he thinks shape how Russia acts in a world becoming more and more hostile day by day? Well, joining me now to discuss all of this is Dr. Ivan Grigoriev, a lecturer in Russian politics at King's College London. Hi, Ivan.
Hi, Chris.
So let's start with that election. Obviously, 87% is a massive margin. We've talked on this podcast a little bit about that, about how the world kind of reacted to that and how politics reacted. But what about the Russian public? How do you think they would have taken that 87% statistic?
Well, I think for them, that's a signal that Putin can make them produce that kind of electoral result, which is, I believe, the primary goal of this whole, you know, performance, this whole show, to make people see, to make the elites, the society see that if Putin wants 87%, he will get 87%.
Do you think it was just purely a peacocking exercise to show the world just how powerful it is, despite everything that we've seen over the war in Ukraine, for example?
I'm not sure if the outside world was the primary audience for this. So the way it was staged, my impression is that the primary audience would probably be the people. So many electoral malpractices used were actually obvious to the population. People were forced to vote at the workplace. It was clear that many electoral procedures were violated. So a significant proportion of the population would either know that they did not want to vote for Putin, yet they voted, or they did not vote for him, and they are surprised at the numbers. Guess for them, it's just, you know, this kind of a picture that says, okay, we are really consolidated. Everybody's supporting Putin. If you're not supporting him, you are in the minority. That in turn would probably have been the signal sent to the main audience, so the elites around Putin. Because for them, it's important to know first that the political system is safe and sound. So their fortunes in Russia, their future, etc., it's secured with Putin. He can produce this kind of result. Second, that it would make no sense for them to try to look elsewhere, because the chances of ousting Putin given this result are really low. And I think it's only the third step when we think, okay, what would the outside world think? Because for the outside world, I would figure it does not look good.
Yeah.
So probably it's not for them that they have put up the show.
Yeah, and you mentioned the outside world there. We know what Russia wants or plans to do with Ukraine. We've seen that with the illegal invasion over the past couple of years. But what about other countries, for example, in the Baltics? For example, you look at Latvia and Estonia, but also to some extent Georgia as well, where we've seen some unrest in parliament over the past couple of days as well. I think a minister punched another minister or something like that, something wild. We don't exactly know what Putin wants or plans for them. Should they be worried about any of that?
Well, they had all the reasons to freak out 2 years ago, February 2022, when the invasion, well, the full-scale invasion started. I really could not believe when the invasion of Ukraine started. So I'm not sure if I'm good at predicting things like that. But I would say that countries, so Latvia, Estonia, they are probably safe because they are NATO members.
Yeah.
I think what Russia has been trying to do, the Kremlin strategy, has been to disrupt other countries' possibilities to join NATO and the EU by instigating territorial disputes in those countries. Much of what has been happening in Ukraine is actually about that. But the same applies to Moldova, the same applies to Georgia that you've mentioned. Once you have these territorial disputes, so currently 20% of Georgia is actually occupied by Russian forces, by Russian troops. Once this has already happened, I would say there is not much to fear, really. So it's like Latvia and Estonia are already past this threshold. They don't have to fear because they are already NATO members. And countries like Georgia, they have not crossed the threshold, and we know they have nothing to fear because there are territorial disputes there. So NATO or the EU would be reluctant to extend an invitation to a country like that. Also, with Georgia, the current government is kind of friendly towards Russia. And I mean, it may seem that as if Russia was kind of bribing the Georgian elites into that. At the same time, if you look at the Georgian GDP, it has been growing throughout the last few years quite significantly. A lot of it comes from Georgian reorientation towards Russia. So even though officially Russia and Georgia are kind of hostile because of the 2008 war, they have restored flights, Moscow-St. Petersburg to Tbilisi, the capital city of Georgia. They have restored trade, tourism, and all of that is really very lucrative for Georgia. So even though Georgians have all the grounds not to like Russia and the Russians, it is kind of economically beneficial for them to still cooperate with Russia. So if I were them, I would not, you know, fear that something would happen.
When you do consider Putin has a list of issues that he has with the West, and so does his inner circle. What are his priorities, do you think, outside of, away from Ukraine with the West? Because it's clear that he wants to make some changes to the geopolitical landscape, but what are they? And realistically, can he get any of them done if, when you look at Ukraine, he's not been able to really achieve any of his goals there, although he would tell you otherwise. So what are his priorities with the West, do you think?
It's a good question. It's really difficult to decipher what's going on in his head. I would say that if we are trying to imagine that there is some strategy behind what he's doing, I would assume that he was trying to create some kind of a buffer zone around Russia or to maintain its existence. I mean, it has existed since the early 1990s. On many accounts, he failed doing that. So whatever he miscalculated with Ukraine, but also that created this cascade with Finland and Sweden that joined NATO. I think if that was a strategy, that was a really stupid one. Currently, most probably his main goal is to just get out of the Ukrainian crisis and at the same time keep the annexed territories, the occupied territories. So Crimea, but also the four regions of Ukraine, parts of which are currently occupied by the Russian troops. I don't think that he thinks any further than that. And it's actually, it's quite unclear where this horizon is. So how close is it, whether he will be able to do that, because it depends on loads of things. US elections, whether the Western assistance to Ukraine will continue, et cetera, et cetera. Whether the Ukrainians will be able to fight as bravely as they've been fighting so far.
What do you think his biggest issues are with the West? If you kind of put it into a collective, what is his biggest problems?
Well, if we are reconstructing that based on what he started saying roughly 2006, 2007, I think he believes that the outcome of the Cold War was unfair for Russia. He thinks that many promises that were made throughout the, well, in the early 90s and then in the 90s more generally, were not kept. He probably thinks all that. But at the same time, much of what he's doing is really targeted at the Russian society. So he's trying to pump up this kind of revanchist agenda. He uses the resentment that exists in the Russian population. To do that credibly, he kind of has to be really vocal on the international arena. You know, what's been called, so at some point they introduced this very useful word to describe Russian foreign strategy. They called, they said Russia was becoming more assertive internationally. Of course, up until the point when everyone started saying that Russia became aggressive on the international arena. But this assertiveness was kind of trying to create crisis primarily for the US wherever it was possible, like Syria or, you know, doing stuff in Ukraine or Moldova.
You mentioned society then. I think that is a huge part of the messaging that Putin and his wider inner circle within the Kremlin talk about in terms of degradation when it comes to the West. For example, I was listening to a report from BBC's Steve Rosenberg, and in that report, he mentioned, for example, Sergei Stepshin, who's a former prime minister, and he was talking about the West being forces of the Antichrist. So they bring religion into a lot of the conversation as well. Why do you think that religion plays a part in the messaging that we hear from the Kremlin when it comes to criticizing the West?
Truth be told, Russians are not particularly religious.
Right.
So many Russians claim that they are Orthodox Christians, ethnic Russians. Of course, there is a huge proportion of the Russian population that are Muslim and that are not ethnically Russian. So if we focus on the ethnically Russian part, which is roughly 75-76% of the population of Russia, they say that they are Orthodox Christian, many of them say, but they do not attend church services. It's an element of post-Soviet identity, really. So they would, some of them would probably attend the Christmas service or the Easter service, and that's pretty much it. At the same time, It's difficult to untangle, but there is this kind of combination of anti-Westernism, which goes through critiques of the Western morality, which is very closely tied to the anti-gay sentiment, which was in turn instigated by the Kremlin itself. Russians did not used to be anti-gay. I mean, you look at the public opinion surveys, and 2005, more than half of the population think that gay and lesbian people, that's how they would formulate it in Russia, should have the same rights with the rest of the population, which is quite strong. Currently, it's 2/3 of the population that say they should not. Right. And much of that was created by propaganda. And that somehow is tied to religiosity, which Russians really do not have that much of. Various political figures, like, for instance, Sergei Stepashin. By the way, he was only a prime minister like for 3 months in 1999. So he did not last long. Vladimir Putin replaced him. So in many cases, they're just using this kind of rhetoric because it's acceptable, because you cannot make a mistake there. You criticize the West. You refer to, you know, Christianity, etc. That's kind of the mainstream. Whether they really mean, they probably mean what they say. They are elderly white men who grew up in the Soviet Union. Many of them have some kind of KGB background. So they probably mean what they say. But if the circumstances would be different, I wouldn't be surprised to hear them say something completely different, to tell the truth.
So do you think in that sense, they're completely out of touch with a majority of the Russian public who might not necessarily look at the West and necessarily care whether they are or they hold religious views that are similar to theirs?
No, not really, no. So for the Russian population, apparently this very strong resentment that a significant proportion of the Russian population has after the 1990s and after all the hardship that the Russian society went through, this resentment is channeled into aspiration to be this, you know, self-righteous nation, you know, which is properly rooted in the real Christianity, whereas, you know, those people in the West, they are, you know, completely decadent and stuff like that. So it's not that many Russians actually traveled abroad and in the West. So I guess Turkey and Thailand would be the two countries that Russians would have visited most often. Well, besides Ukraine, of course. So a lot of propaganda they see on TV, they do believe. They tend to believe, especially people older than 50 years old.
Yeah. And what about the propaganda when it comes to Ukraine, for example? You mentioned it just there. How strong is that propaganda that the Kremlin puts out to its own public?
And it's incredibly strong.
Do they believe it?
Yeah. It's like a steamroller that, you know, keeps rolling over and over on the Russian population. I've been thinking about that just recently because I was talking to a friend who had the misfortune of talking to her mother about the recent terrorist attack in Moscow.
Yeah.
And even though all of the evidence suggests that this has completely nothing to do with Ukraine. Her mother believed that Ukraine somehow was connected to it. And the fact that it's possible, I mean, that's just one instance, but the fact that it's possible to turn the public opinion that way, well, it might be that Russians are just so impressionable. But, I mean, the extent to which the propaganda, you know, the extent to which Russians are being brainwashed every day is very high, especially on issues like Ukraine.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts. It's really quite strange to me to see quite how far Vladimir Putin has gone in terms of becoming more isolated from the West, because I think it was in 1999 that he said that he couldn't see a future where Russia became isolated from Europe. And now fast forward to today, it's almost completely adrift from the rest of Europe, isn't it? Does that surprise you how far he's gone in his ideology?
Well, now it does not, but I mean, if you think about it that way, then yeah, that's of course a big change.
On that word change, what has changed? Like, why has Putin decided to take Russia so far away from the rest of Europe?
I guess there was a point when he tried to just keep power in Russia.
Right.
It became apparent to everyone that that's what he's trying to do, that he's basically usurping the power in 2011 when, you know, they swapped seats with the then president and next prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev. At this point, the public support for him went down quite significantly. And what they started doing then at that point is they invented this combination of two strategies. One, this kind of international assertiveness, which started with, you know, Ukraine and Syria, et cetera, using this to create this rally around the flag effect inside the country. And on the other hand, they're creating something, some kind of a conservative agenda. This is where the religiosity comes from, et cetera. And the more they are doing that, the more they are stuck with that. Besides, when they first used this international agenda in 2014, when Crimea was annexed, it was a very successful move for Vladimir Putin, for his popularity, for his support. So they might have thought, okay, if we repeat that again, which is what they've done in 2022, that might have the same effect, which it kind of did. But on the other hand, it's unclear to what extent it's genuine, because in 2014, there was no censorship, and currently Russia lives under military censorship. It was much less repressive towards the opposition, towards the activist, etc. Currently, we are not sure if the emotion is genuine and if it will not dissipate once, you know, state becomes less repressive towards its citizens.
Just to look in the other direction for a second, this drift that we've seen away from Europe by Russia has kind of pushed them a little bit more further towards Xi Jinping and China and developing a relationship there. What do you think Russia and the Kremlin specifically sees the relationship with China? Is it one for now, or is it a potential long-term strong friendship?
I think they want it to be a long-term friendship. They really have no other choice, right? So Russian economy is largely exporting mineral resources and oil and gas. Russia doesn't have many ports, so a lot of these exports should be by land.
Yeah.
And then you look around, you see that basically it's either Europe or China. Another good partner would be India, but I mean, there you need to go by sea. On the one hand, there is not much choice. On the other hand, I mean, I think when Putin, during his first two administrations, so in the 2000s, when he was saying that Russia is part of Europe, etc., I think that's what he thinks, really. I'm not sure if China would be his first choice.
Right.
I mean, he has... So his career was in Germany in the 1980s when he was working in the KGB. He speaks German. Much of his work was actually with people from the West.
Yeah.
He has contacts mostly with people from the West. I wonder how confident he is when he communicates with the Chinese. So whether he is sure that the toolkit that he has, and he has quite a toolkit because, I mean, he was trained that way, whether it applies to the Chinese.
Yeah. And then just finally, what would it take, do you think, for Russia to reintegrate with Europe? Would it take the death of Putin, for example? Or if Putin were to disappear, would his legacy be carried on by his inner circle that he keeps around him? And would they continue to push away from Europe? What do you think would bring Russia back to Europe? Anything?
That's a good question. Part of the question is whether... So, for instance, when Putin dies, would Russia necessarily reintegrate? I think there is there is definitely a problem with integrating Russia into Europe or into NATO in terms of... So there are many technical obstacles to that. Russia is huge. I mean, not geographically, but it's a huge market. It's 140 million people. So any kind of economic integration with Russia is really difficult to achieve on the level that, you know, the European Union could integrate, for instance, Estonia, a much smaller country in terms of the size of the market and the population. So any kind of economic integration would probably not go further than a free trade area, most probably. And that's not big, really. I mean, the free trade area, you kind of can achieve it at the level of the WTO. Military integration is difficult to achieve first because Russia and the West have historically been adversaries in terms of, you know, nuclear arsenals, etc. How do you build trust there? It's really difficult. On the other hand, maybe it would sound less important, but, you know, it is important. Russia and the West have completely different military standards. Integrating would mean that one of them would have to override those standards, which would probably have to be Russia, which kind of means disarmament, if you think about it. Russia will not go there. So I think a good roadmap for this reintegration would probably be to just recognize that Russia is not part of those organizations, that it's more of a neighbor, and that you do not need Russia to move in, but you just need good neighborly relationship with Russia. It would really be difficult for the West to think about that after the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
It would probably also be very difficult for the Russian society to accept that, because they would have to go through realizing that this is what we've done in Ukraine. I mean, there would need to be some reckoning. People would not want to reckon with that. Yeah, so I would not expect Russia to reintegrate in any way in the next decades.
Yeah, it really does seem as though the relationship with Russia and Europe and the UK, where, you know, we are, really seems like it's been ruined. Whatever existed beforehand has kind of completely gone, and a way back to any kind of conversation really seems quite difficult. Ivan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, if you enjoy our episodes and want to hear more exactly like this, then why not back us on Patreon for just £3 a month? That's the equivalent of just one posh coffee. You'll get all of our episodes first, ad-free, as well as access to our exclusive merchandise. I'm Chris Jones, reporting from The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people, and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Chris Jones. The producer was Eliza Davis-Beard, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.